From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on November 1st, 2003, in Raleigh, North Carolina. A man named Robert Beter was driving drunk. He had taken an alternate route in an effort to avoid police because he didn't want to get caught drinking and driving. Up ahead, an accident had happened, and some drivers had stopped to help a person who was injured. Robert was heading in that direction. He and his van crested the hill, and he saw the people on the road, but he couldn't stop in time. He recalls trying to swerve, to miss the group. It was too late. Six people died in that horrible collision, and Robert Beter has taken full responsibility. He has maintained that it was his fault. He has replayed the moment in his mind. He has contemplated ways he could even begin to atone for taking the lives of six people. And he's gone to prison. Beter spent more than 8 years in prison, most of his 30s. But that is now not how his story ends. Robert Beter met a woman in prison who he would marry. He had a daughter. He began to appreciate the mundane parts of life, like just going to the grocery store. He meditated, and he never stopped thinking of what he had to do to appreciate the opportunity that he has at life when six people had that taken away. Robert became a behavioral health therapist and addiction counselor, working with others as they navigate anxiety, stress, sobriety, recovery. It is particularly difficult when he works with someone in early recovery because Robert tends to see himself, very little hope, perhaps suicidal, but he is the evidence that there can be hope. And today he's pursuing his own practice as a recovery coach. That is particularly important during the opioid epidemic, and we'll talk about that. This hour, we welcome Robert Beter to Connections. I am so glad you're here. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, we have a lot to talk about in terms of the work that you're doing now, because you have written about the fact that just being in the line of work you're in the opioid epidemic, that work has got to be staggeringly tough. But before we even get there, what I want to do is I want to work through some of your early story and then not spend the bulk of the hour on it. Because
sure.
Your story is who you are now and what you've learned and the wisdom that you're bringing to this conversation.
Yeah.
In your, were you drinking a lot into your 30s? You were only, what, 30, 31 when the accident happened?
I think I was 32.
32?
I might have been 31. I don't remember the math exactly.
But when did you really start drinking heavily?
I had always used drugs and alcohol, mm-hmm. and I used those two things pretty interchangeably through, from a very early age. I think, you know, like many people who struggle with substance use disorders, I started in high school, with experimentation, and I would say that for me, even at that early age, when I'd go to a party and drink with other friends,
yeah.
or would get high with other friends, even then they would look at me and kind of go like, you're kind of doing something different than the rest of us are doing here.
Just doing it harder, hitting it harder.
Yeah. I had a pretty, amazing capacity for just consuming things, you know? And there's physiological reasons for that people with substance use disorders. But,
well, and there's, you know. and frankly, as we've learned, you know, I can pick up a drink and I'm not an alcoholic.
Yeah.
It's not a risk to me.
Yeah.
And so there's differences probably in our DNA from
yeah.
person to person. So you were someone who could, you know, your friends are drinking at a party, but you're going at it maybe harder than them. Or
yeah, with
kind
a vengeance.
Of up and,
yeah.
And you have written that even early on, you had kind of scoffed at the idea of meditation. It was almost like substance abuse was your medication, but meditation to you was kind of strange.
I remember many years ago. I think I must have been like 18 or something, and I was going to try this yoga and meditation class, and I had gone to a local church that was offering it in the community, and there was a man who sat in the front of the classroom, and he sat in a rocking chair, sort of took on this persona of a guru, and he would sort of guide people through the different postures and stuff. And then I remember even there, I was just really turned off by it. I thought, whatever people are getting out of this, I'm not getting out of it. And then also, I think the messaging itself about meditation can be socially pretty poor. We always look at it as like, oh, it's going to be this great relaxing thing, and I'm going to have such a great time. And the reality is if meditation was relaxing, then when I walked into the lobby here in this building, everybody would be doing that, you know. But that's not what people do to relax. One of the benefits of meditation is you learn how to be calm in mm-hmm. stressful situations, but it's not relaxing, you know.
Well, so you spent your early adulthood sort of hitting, as you said, alcohol and substances yeah. hard. You even found girlfriends who were more tolerant of it.
Yeah. I think
you lost some relationships, gained others.
Yeah, I think I dated several women who had been grown up in homes where that was sort of normal, and so I was sort of playing out the role that they grew up with, you know.
No, that, I find that very interesting. You write so forthrightly, and in fact, just about everything about you seems to be all about accountability.
Yeah.
And that's why, I told Robert before the program began that what I wanted to do was spend most of this hour just talking about the work that he's doing. We have to talk about the accident. It's part of his story. It's part of the reason that he's here. But I don't want to belabor the point, and I don't want to do it in a way that is gratuitous. But the reason I wanted to understand more about who you are is sort of what built up to that night. I find it interesting. You know, you had one girlfriend, as you write, kind of say, I don't want this anymore. And so you just found a different girlfriend who would put up with it.
Right.
And you were finding ways to continue to live the way you lived. You would take an alternate route home if you thought a cop might catch you drinking and driving.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Even the night of the accident wasn't my first time ever driving intoxicated. You know, I mean, I think I'd spent whole years driving every day to work and from work high, and then, you know, would go to the bar and have drinks at the bar and then drive home. My idea of not driving under the influence was like if I was staggering and I felt like I might not be able to manage the vehicle, then I was too drunk to drive. And,
wow.
You know, and that's a poor measurement, you know?
Well, yes, but look, if we're just going to be straight, like, let's just be real, because you're an accountable person, right?
Yeah.
I've gotten behind the wheel after having a couple of glasses of wine at a party.
Yeah.
And I don't know too many people listening who probably haven't.
Yeah.
And the notion of what we can handle or what's acceptable, we all kind of have a different threshold of what we think is too much. So all you were doing, and I'm not at all waving it away.
Yeah.
But what you were doing is your own version of finding what you thought was too much. And for you, too much was you literally have blurry vision or you're going to fall down.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you probably could handle it.
Because I had handled it so many times before. Yeah. So you keep upping the ante of what's okay, you know. And as I said, you know, and I think that's supported by evidence, too. I think, I don't remember the exact statistic. I think Mothers Against Drunk Driving says something like, the average person who gets pulled over for a DWI charge gets away with it something like, I forget, 80, 100 times. I would say it was much higher than that, you know.
Mm.
I've said this a bunch through the past, but as a culture, we're just very accepting of this. You know, when I talk about publicly, when I talk about methods that we could use to try to stop people from drinking and driving, people have an aversive reaction to that, you know. So,
why do you think they do?
It would crush our entertainment industry. It would, you know, I mean, we go to any, it's a Friday night, go to any bar tonight and watch who leaves, you know. And the reality is most of those people aren't getting pulled over and most of those people aren't sober, you know.
But if you ask most of those people, are you drinking and driving?
Yeah.
I bet you most would say no.
No, yeah.
They'd probably say, well, I'm not drunk driving. Yeah. I think most people would say no.
Yeah, and their friends would support that. Most people would not be opposed. In fact, I maybe we should steer clear of generalization. So what I find is that people aren't opposed to driving under the influence a little bit. They're really mad at me. You know, they're really mad when people turn out to be bad at it. You know, when something happens, we want to throw the heaviest books we have at the people, throw them under the jail, you know. And the reality is that it's just part of our culture, you know.
So had you had any close calls before the accident in 2003?
Not one that I can think of.
Nothing. Never. Nothing stands out.
Yeah.
So as you write, there had been a previous accident on that roadway in Raleigh, North Carolina in 2003, and somebody had been injured and some other people had sort of pulled over to try to help, and so there was kind of a scrum in the roadway of trying to help.
But they kind of did all the right things. They did what you want people to do, you know.
Sure.
They saw something and they had contacted 911, you know.
Do you know how fast you were going?
I wasn't speeding. I think that was determined. I never read the discovery about the accident. I still haven't. I don't think I could. But I wasn't weaving, I wasn't speeding, but you know, I was intoxicated, and so I came over a hill, and I didn't have the ability to sort of assess and react to what was happening in front of me. You know, my reaction times were slowed. You know,
and it might have been a case that I don't want to assume, but it might have been one of those cases where, you know, if you're sober, in less than one second.
Yeah.
You can hit a brake or you can assess.
Do something.
And if you have sort of a delayed reaction, as you write on your website, it was too late.
Yeah. And I also struggled with this because there was a lot of post-accident, and this still happens sometimes with when I talk about this with people, is that they'll talk to me and they find out they kind of like me, okay, and so they'll sort of like look for justifications to forgive what I had done, you know. So they'll go, well, you know, if the accident hadn't happened, or you know, if I don't know, just lots of different justifications. Mm-hmm. And I struggled with that because even the court system did that. You know, they were the reason they didn't lock me up forever. My understanding is because I didn't cause the initial accident, you know, and so there was a lot of conjecture about whether or not that accident would have occurred had I been sober. So when I was laying on my bunk for years in a prison cell, I really was running through this whole thing in my head over and over of like, what if I had done this differently? What if I had done that differently? If only I had all the things that we do. And I finally realized that I took that road because I was trying to avoid police. That was my game. That was how I lived. And so had I not been intoxicated that night, I wouldn't have taken that road, you know, and that accident wouldn't have happened, and those people would be alive, and, you know. So at that point, there's just no denying it. It was just my fault. You know?
Six people died. Have you heard from family, surviving family?
Yeah, I've had some really good, very kind, intimate conversations with some of them, and then some of them have I've tried to reach out to at times, and many years ago, and they had asked me just not to contact them. And you know, I have a daughter now, and I'm not sure I could be as forgiving as the as people have been towards me. You know, I think if somebody had taken my daughter's life, I don't care how well they do in the world, I don't care what kind of amends they make in the world, I don't want to hear from them. You know,
you can understand the wide range of reactions.
Yeah.
Ooh, well, look, I want to tell you again, I mean, no one is sitting here sort of waving away what happened, but your accountability is part of your story. I mean, you've said, it's my fault, and you're going to do what you have to do. What you had to do was go to prison. You were there for more than 8 years?
Yeah, about 8.5, so close to that.
Later this hour, I want to talk about prison reform, and Robert has written some very interesting... First of all, he's a fantastic writer.
Thanks.
What's the website? I would like people to check it out.
So I've got a...
Do you not know your website? Oh, no.
it's called... I've got a blog called The Prison Sketches.
Okay.
And I'm sort of...
That's what I was reading.
Poor
off,
about
right?
updating it.
Well, I mean... I think you wrote in June, and then you had one in March, and then one in January.
At some point, I decided I was going to sit down and start working on a book, and so I sort of had to drop the blog to be able to have the time to do
gotcha.
That.
Gotcha. Well, I'm gonna quote from some of your writing this hour because I find it really moving and really important. So, listeners, I'll make sure that we post if you want to take a look at what Robert has written about. And each post is different. Each piece focuses on something different, and as we'll talk about. But we are going to talk about prison reform because 8+ years in prison, you learn a lot. You learn a lot about dehumanization of people.
I was stunned.
And we're going to get into that.
Yeah.
But I want to talk a little bit about addiction recovery.
Sure.
You know, you've come to know a lot of people in this community, people who've been on this program.
This is the best community. I mean, honestly, I'm biased. My wife and I both love Rochester. We really do. But there is such a huge... heartfelt, connected, just thriving recovery community in Rochester. It's just a great place, and that was just luck. We just moved up here. So,
yeah, I was gonna. You know. Well, let's talk about that. Why did you? Where did you grow up originally?
Kind of all over down south, mostly. You know, I predominantly North Carolina. Mm-hmm. My family, we lived in South Carolina when I was very young, and my mother and her side of the family is from Alabama. I spent a year in college there, and. So I went to high school in Georgia, so really all over down south.
You know. Do you, sort of apropos of nothing, I'm just curious.
Sure.
Do you miss what the South smells like? I love the smell. I love the Low Country Carolina. I love the way
See, I love Rochester. I'm so biased.
I mean, every time I get a chance to be in the Carolinas or go to the South, it just feels, I just sort of like breathe it in. You don't miss it.
So we're in July, heading into August now.
So you wouldn't want to be there now. Yeah, so I don't mean now. There's some time I would definitely not want to be down there, but February for sure.
Yeah, but even winters there are different because, and I learned that up here because I always hated winters because I was always so cold, and then you move up here and you buy the clothes for it, and you're like, oh, I can be warm, I don't have to be cold, but you don't do that down south, you know, because
deal with it and complain?
Yeah, because winter doesn't last that long, you know, so it's like nobody has an air conditioner up here, you know, and down there you wouldn't do that because you'd die, you know?
So what brought you to Rochester?
My wife had gotten so I had been released to Charleston, South Carolina. Which was where my wife was living, and she was from New York, and you know, at that point, I could go anywhere, and she was in a postdoctoral residency, and so she was nearing completion of that, and she was looking for jobs, and so we looked at a couple of different places, and Rochester, New York came up, and so we were like, well, let's go look at the place. No, we didn't know anything about Rochester, you know. She was from Westchester County, and so we came up here. She interviewed at jobs, and I rented a bicycle from a local bike shop and just toured the canal and, you know, rode all over the city and left, thinking we were just madly in love with the place. And
I love that.
Oh, we moved up, and we haven't regretted a day of it since. It's honestly just neat people, salt of the earth people, you know.
So, I love hearing that. Yeah. It's really gratifying because I'm also not from here originally.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, moved here not necessarily thinking I'd stay. It's hard to leave. It's a lot harder to leave than people realize.
Yeah, yeah. But there is sort of a nice thing about being a stranger in a town, so I appreciate the things that other people are like, what do you mean?
Isn't that interesting, though? Because, you know, the people who grew up in probably in just about any given place, you know, you probably love it and you're defensive of it, but you also, you know, you either get bored with it or you see the warts.
Right.
Whereas the outsiders, we can come in and be like, oh, man, you're missing this.
I was just having coffee at a local cafe down the street from Susan B. Anthony's house. Are you kidding me?
You know? I love that. That's such a great point. So, and by the way, you met your wife where?
So I was locked up at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was, are you allowed to tell the story?
Yeah. I'd love to. I'm not sure that an hour would cover it. But, you know, so I am a writer, and right after the accident, this is kind of magical. So Kara, my wife, had lived in Fishkill, New York, on a mountain next to my mother, so in the middle of nowhere. And she was going through kind of a separation that was leading to a divorce at the time. They're still friends. He's a good guy. And my mother, you know, would go over there at the time and say, like, why don't you come hang out at my house, or we'll go down to the local, you know, cannery or whatever and help out and do volunteer stuff, or we can can foods, or they just hang out. And whenever they were hanging out together, my mother would say to my now wife, you know, there's something about you. Whenever I spend time with you, it's almost like I'm spending time with my son, you know. Well, I was down south at the time, and I was in a relationship. There was nothing, so she wasn't trying to insinuate anything romantic, you know. And things happened, and my parents ended up moving back to Alabama, and Kara had moved to Charleston, South Carolina, and ended up, in, you know, trying to save her marriage there, and it just didn't work out. And so years had gone by, and this was also pre-social media, pre-sort of the internet boom. So some years had gone by, and they had sort of lost contact with each other. And then, you know, my disease was escalating. I was getting sicker and sicker. And so I was pulling back from being in touch with my family at all, which is what you do when you're sort of at the height of addiction. You just don't want to be around people. You don't want people to know what you're doing, in part to protect them. You know, you don't want them to worry. And then the accident happened. And the way Kara tells it was she started having these nightmares about my mother. And they just wouldn't go away. And so finally she tracked her down. She like found her phone number, did something, searched her out, and called her out of nowhere, you know, back when they had like flip phones, you know, and called her and said, I'm having these really terrible nightmares about you. Is everything okay? And it had been like 2 weeks after the accident. And so, Kara said, what can I do? You know? And you know, my mother said, well, he's suicidal right now. I mean, they've got him on suicide watch. But he's a writer, and maybe someday, if you know, if he lives through this, maybe you could you two could start writing. And so I had started writing. I was just talking to one of your coworkers downstairs that I consider myself a writer because I write as a reaction to life. So I haven't been published in a lot of things. It's just sort of what I do. And so sometimes something will happen and I'll respond to it through writing. So I was doing that while I was locked up. I was writing stories about, you know, the men I would meet and about my experiences in prison and just the things that were happening around me, trying to make sense of it all, you know, find meaning and it all. And then I guess I had been locked up about 4 years, and I got a letter in the mail that said, hey, my mother would type these things up and just email them out to everybody in the world, and Kara had been on that list. So one day I got a letter in the mail that said, you don't know me, but I was your mother's neighbor on the mountain in Fishkill, and I've been reading your stuff for years, and if you just want somebody to write to, I'd be happy to write. And so there was nothing romantic about those letters. It was, you know, she was like having a diary that would write back, you know. We'd write about just anything, the things that were happening to me, things that were happening in her life, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It didn't matter, just anything that was going on, we just write about. And I was in school, and I was in classes in school, and I was about to graduate with an associate's degree. And so I had said, you know, my parents are going to be coming to that from Alabama, and you haven't seen them in years. If you'd like, you could come to that graduation ceremony. I was allowed to have 3 visitors. And so she came, and that was the first time we had met each other face to face. We never exchanged pictures. And even that wasn't like a love at first sight moment, you know. She just started realizing she could drive, and she came more and more frequently. And then after years, we started realizing that that this was who we needed to spend our lives with, each other, you know.
What an amazing story.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what I want to do is I want to read from one of the pieces of writing you have about the ways that incarceration can dehumanize us. Yeah. And I'm going to go ahead and read from this, and then we're going to talk a little bit about what you think it meant, but also how you spent your time in prison trying to avoid that feeling of sort of dehumanization. Yeah. So in this particular piece, you're writing about men who would wait in line and get ready for lunch.
Oh.
And this is what you write. Quote, as the clock ticked closer to lunch, grown men would start hoarding around the door. I have no good reason for this, but I absolutely hated it. I mean, I abhorred this behavior. I love my dogs, but that is what this was. It was the behavior of dogs, who always seemed convinced that for some reason or another, they would not get fed. They would pace with anticipation. The food wasn't good, and every one of those men would complain about it while eating it. That didn't matter, though. This was what mattered, that they got there first. I knew men, friends of mine, men whom I actually liked, that would stand at that door for hours so that they wouldn't have to wait in line, end quote. You got to the point where you didn't even let yourself watch that, you said.
No, I'd go into my cell, lock my door, and blast my headphones so that I didn't have to hear it and read and pretend it wasn't happening.
And so when you say, I don't know why, but I absolutely hated this, or I have no good reason for this, my observation in just sort of reading that is you hated that because you knew what prison was doing to those men. That wasn't necessarily who those people were, yeah, but they were becoming less of people,
yeah,
in a system that didn't treat them like people.
Yeah.
You agree with that?
It's a horrific system. I think in 200 years, people are going to look back in horror at what we're doing right now with our criminal justice system. You know.
You talked, and you're writing about the little windows of time in which people could go outside.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's sort of prison specific. So they'd, you know, we'd have first yard would be a couple of hours in the morning, and then they'd shut it down, and then they'd give you a second yard in the afternoon, and then if it was later in the summer where the hours were longer, they'd give you a third yard. But sometimes they just turn, you know, whatever officer happened to be on, if they felt like closing down the yard, they would. So,
well. And as we talk about whether it's time outside in prison or the way that people feel dehumanized, you know, I'm thinking of listeners in the past who have expressed a feeling that we need strong deterrents, that look at you, they'll say, look at Robert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not incarcerated anymore.
Right.
And that terrible experience, that dehumanizing experience, might have convinced you to do the kinds of things you needed to do, never to go back.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
a really good friend of mine that I was locked up with said this very well, that if what you did wasn't the wake up call, then prison's not going to be either. You know, I changed my life that night. You know, and prison could have benefited me. And I'll say that as somebody who believes in prison reform, but we're missing out on a hugely valuable opportunity right now. You know, we have people who have mental health disorders and are struggling with addiction. That's who's incarcerated, you know, but we're not treating those things. We're treating them minimally. You know, that's not what prisons do. What the prisons do are to discipline and punish, you know, and it doesn't work with children and it doesn't work with adults. You know, the men I met honestly, some of the best men that I've met in my life were ironically behind bars, you know, and will be for the rest of their lives. The men I met out on the weight pile that were there every day getting bigger, that's what you see on TV, right? They're just trying to get bigger so they can go out and do more crime. But the reality is they were out on the weight pile every day because they were looking for a way to get better at being themselves, you know? They just didn't know how to be better, you know? And that was something they could do. I can be healthier, you know? I can go walk enough laps and lift enough weights. And I had great conversations out on the weight pile. You know, we had this tiny, tiny prison library and everybody I knew read so much all the time, but the books were trash, you know, they were romance and Western. And it's not that those things don't have value. You know, there's something to be said for just reading for entertainment. I do it myself, but they wanted to be reading good books. They didn't know what to read and there was nobody there to guide them, you know? And I'll say this further, it's like nobody knew my crime was never to be discussed the entire time I was incarcerated. If I brought it up with a case manager or a caseworker, they would say, like, that's not really their job. They don't want to talk about that, you know? I was given, because I had a fairly progressive judge, the first prison they sent me to had mental health counseling. And so I was allowed to see, because he was concerned that I was suicidal, they sent me to this prison based on their recommendation. They let me see a psychologist. I had 3 half-hour sessions with that person, you know? I'm a counselor myself. There's nothing I could do with an hour and a half of counseling.
3 half-hour sessions,
yeah.
For you.
For me.
To kind of grapple with the crime you had committed.
Yeah.
The impact that was going to have on you emotionally. And again, I want to say to listeners who may think, well, Evan, you're glossing over the victim. I really don't intend to do that. And I don't think Robert does either.
Not at all.
You know, we're not belaboring the point of what happened in the accident and yes, the crime. If you're just joining us, in November 1st, 2003 in Raleigh, North Carolina, Robert was driving drunk, drove up over a hill and kind of came upon a previous accident scene where there were people in the roadway and did not stop in time and crashed into the scene. 6 people died, and he went to prison for more than 8 years for that. 3 30-minute sessions with the psychologist.
Yeah.
Very little emphasis on your mental health, on what that meant going forward.
It's not what they do, you know, and so, you know, they don't, they're, it's just not what people are sent to prison to do, right? So they're sort of putting this time out, and you know, for those of us that are getting back out, that want to get better, you can sort of take programs. There's things in there, but they're not well run. You know, there's very little oversight of it. You know, and so what you have is a lot of religious services, which can be valuable. You know, I guess. And I was lucky again. The prison that I was sent to did offer classes. So sometimes that gets misunderstood too, because people think, well, you know, you can get locked up and just go to college, and it doesn't quite work like that. I did go to college while I was incarcerated, so. They offered 2 different programs. I could take culinary arts or I could take horticulture. I got an associate's degree in both. But it didn't matter what they offered. I would have taken basket weaving, gladly. I just needed something to do to occupy my brain. And the people who ran those programs were from the local community college. They were good people. You know, they weren't doing anything wrong. It was just very limited. The reason they offer those 2 programs is because that's what prisons need. They need people that can mow lawns, and they need people who can cook food, you know. And so that's sort of what the limiting barrier is. And they also offered correspondence courses. I took a few of those, and even there, so some of the guys I was locked up with had sex crimes. They weren't allowed to take correspondence courses. Or if you had had a crime that was a certain kind of murder, I think you couldn't take a correspondence course. I never understood how those things were justified, you know.
Did you have any conversations about your addiction when you were incarcerated?
They had 12-step programs inside, and so I would go to all of those, but even those were so a little funny because so many people were mandated to go, right? And so I was very serious about my recovery, and a few of us really were, you know. But we would go into a room with 60, 70 men who are all in there for drug-related charges, and they had to be at that meeting, you know. They didn't want to be at that meeting. And so there were like six or seven of us that were actually having some sort of 12-step meeting and trying to get better. And then we'd have, you know, 60 people that were playing cards, rapping, singing, writing letters, whatever else. And so, and also because of how prisons work, there's just not much you're going to talk about out loud, you know. It's not a great place to go and talk about your feelings.
Sure.
You know?
And I remember 2002, I was a reporter for the CBS affiliate in Charleston, West Virginia, and had a conversation with the head of corrections for West Virginia. And he made a comment to me that was pretty crass, and I'm going to euphemize and paraphrase it here, but it has stuck with me. He said, way too often, people are released from prison. And he said, what you ought to be thinking about is, he's basically saying, sexual activity. That was the, and he said, too often they're thinking about getting high the first day out. And he said he can't believe how many people still leave prison and are out there going out to get high, because he said the issue of addiction or substance abuse hasn't even been addressed.
Yeah.
And that was the point he was making to me, and that was 17 years ago.
Yeah. I wouldn't say so.
It was a crass comment.
Yeah.
He was trying
to
make a point.
Again, most of the guys I was locked up with, many of the guys that I was locked up with, didn't want to get high again. They just didn't know how not to. And I had a real moment of
clarity.
That's
an important distinction, probably, yeah.
I had a moment of clarity, and it was pretty. It was in a sociology class, of all things, and I had been locked up for a couple of years, and I was in this class, and I was with just a bunch of really good guys who had grown up in impoverished neighborhoods and in abusive homes, and I knew their stories, you know, and they knew mine, And I had always lived on kind of, I guess, I don't know the right way to say this, but sort of the wrong side of town. It's just where I gravitated. It's where I went every time. And I was in the sociology class, and we were talking about structuralism, and it was my first exposure to that. And I started looking around at all these friends of mine, and I'm looking at them thinking, like, you know, so I said they don't know the right books to read. They don't know the right classes to take. Nobody's telling them what those things are, you know. But I did know, you know. So I grew up with parents who were book collectors, and they loved to read still, you know. And so I knew what the sort of culturally important books were that we were supposed to read. I was just making a choice not to. Mm-hmm. And I looked at them and I thought, I've got to stop doing this. I've got to stop living in broke neighborhoods and broken neighborhoods and start living the way other people live, you know, the people that don't go to jail, you know, and they would forgive me that. They'd understand I had a way to get out, you know. I knew the language. I knew how to move between cultures, so that wasn't that difficult for me, you know. And I will say that I'm still in touch with some of those guys today, and many of those guys have gone on to great success.
Before our only break of the hour, tell me what you would do right now if they said, you're reforming prison. What's the short list of things you would change about prison?
So that sounds really hokey, but the cheapest one is I stared at a ceiling every night nearly 5 years before I transferred to a minimum custody. It would have been great if they had painted mathematical algorithms on that ceiling, or constellations for me to memorize, or if every time I sat down at the same table at the chow hall, there were things painted there. It would have been more interesting to look at. We had great artists, you know. So that may be too simple, but it was just, you know, if I had been walking down the halls and seen poetry on the walls, you know, how different would that be, you know, to inspire people to learn, you know, because like I said, the willingness is there. And this is across the board. That's a very oversimplified version. But the willingness to learn and get better and grow is there. We have the captive audience, you know, but we don't have, but nothing's being offered, you know.
So literally, it sounds that the approach is got to change. That you picked an example of something that would be, you know, maybe inspiring or helpful, or at least something different, more thoughtful. But it sounds like you don't think that the approach, generally speaking, is one that is very humanizing.
No, well, we need to start with compassion. I mean, across the board, you know, the thing that I say to people now when I'm out in the public talking about my story is the inevitable question people ask me about my own victim is like, how would you feel if it was your daughter, you know? And I can't objectively answer that question.
I don't think anybody can.
Right. There's no way for me to do that. But the other question that we need to ask is what would I want to happen with my daughter if she had been the one who had committed the crime, you know? And the answer to that's so different, you know? If my child had grown up to murder somebody or horrifically rape somebody or anything, what would I want to see happen to that person, you know? And what I'd want to see is for them to be treated compassionately and humanely and with a way that they can get better and grow, you know? Even if we're going to keep them incarcerated for the rest of their lives, even if that's going to happen. You know, because I had friends that are never getting out of there, you know? And they're never getting out of there in part because they would hurt people, you know? And this is hard to say, but they're kind of not bad people, you know? They still have the need for the same things that you and I have needs for, which is love.
Well, history shows and research shows they've probably been deprived of those things from a very early age.
So we're taking the most abused among us and inflicting them with more pain and more suffering, you know? And I just think we can do better than that. We're better people than that.
Robert Veeder is my guest. We'll get some of your feedback in just a moment here. He's an addiction counselor pursuing his own practice as a recovery coach in Rochester. And let's get that break and continue the conversation with him next. Coming up in our second hour, United Kingdom has a new prime minister. Boris Johnson met with the Queen this week, and he is the leader now of the United Kingdom with his eyes set on Brexit. He says leaving the EU has to happen before the end of October. Donald Trump has celebrated the elevation of Boris Johnson to prime minister. So what do Brits think? And what should we think? We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Want to get a phone call? This is Betty in Rochester. I'm with Robert Veeder. Go ahead, Betty.
Hello.
Hi.
Betty, are you there? Yeah, I can hear you, Betty. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I was just listening, and I have just a couple of comments. One is that you said several times that it's our culture to drink and drive, and I don't think that's true at all. Maybe 50 years ago when my brother was killed, it was our culture to drink and drive. But now our culture is get a designated driver. If you're going to drink, make sure that you have another method, another way to get home, whether it's Uber or a taxi. Maybe have one drink and wait an hour before you get in the vehicle and drive. And so it was really disturbing to me to hear that said several times. It's our culture, because I think our culture has finally awakened to the fact that it's a choice to drink and drive.
Betty, if I can just say, first of all, I mean, I'm terribly sorry about your loss.
And I
would ask you, you know, gently, I'm not trying to be provocative at all, but, you know, have you been out any time in recent years to, you know, like a bar in Rochester, establishments that serve, you know, here in the city, for example, on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday night?
Right. Right. Well, people who go to a bar to drink on Friday night are already making the choice to drink and drive, unless they have a designated driver. I have several friends who are alcoholics, full-blown alcoholics, they never get in the car and drive when they've been drinking.
Yeah, I'm really glad they don't.
They buy their alcohol and they stay home. And I've had to separate from them because I just can't stand that attitude of let's get drunk every night. But I hear more and more people saying, I would never drink and drive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it was just hurtful for me to hear that it's our culture because, I think that justifies it with people. They say, mm-hmm. well, yeah, it is, you know, so I'm going out drinking this weekend.
Yeah, so
but even young people, you know, five people will go out. And one in the group is the designated driver.
Yep. So let me just jump in, Betty, and say, first of all, much love to you, and I really appreciate the call. I'll let Robert kind of jump in a moment, but I'll say I think you're right to say that there's a lot more discussion on do you have a designated driver? Is one person in the group not going to drink? Now that there is Uber and Lyft, whatever you think about Uber and Lyft and their practices, does that open more of an avenue for people to get around without having to drive if they've been drinking at all? Absolutely. And I think that's a very good thing. I'll let Robert clarify the point, but I didn't disagree with him at all because I think what I hear him saying is a lot of people will drink maybe not nearly as hard as he used to, mm-hmm. but still think, well, I'm okay to drive. You know, I've been at a house party. I've had two or three beers over a few hours. I can drive. And I think that is still part of the culture that is not an observation that seeks to justify that. Right, in fact, it's a concern. How do you view it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I apologize, Betty, if I sort of misstated my position on that. I'm certainly not trying to normalize it or give permission to it. The reason I come on today is because I want people to think about drinking and driving and not do it. And I think you're right. I think there are more alternatives now, and so that's becoming easier. People are starting to plan for that. I still think, you know, my wife and daughter and I go to a lot of live music events. We go to a lot of concerts and see people stagger out to their cars by the hundreds, more than I could ever stop, you know. And there's usually one officer down at the end, and he's waving them out onto the roads, you know. And the officer knows not everybody there had one beer and waited for an hour and a half for that to metabolize before they got behind the wheel. So it's sort of accepted at that sort of level.
Not to say the police are encouraging that, but,
no,
but it'd be overwhelming.
Yeah, there's no way you could. And I do this personally. I will say that right after I got out of prison, I went to a wedding with my wife, and we watched people who knew my story, right, that were staggering out to their cars. And there we did say something, you know. But now we leave parties early because I just can't stop everybody, you know.
Let me grab Ingrid in Penfield who wants to jump in there too. Go ahead, Ingrid.
Hi. Thanks to your guest. I don't actually want to address your guest other than to say that I completely agree that we need to treat everybody with compassion, and we would be doing a lot better at treating addictive people if we were to meet them with compassion. Mm-hmm. Addiction is a disease. It is not like a disease. It's not that we're saying that cutesy. It is a disease, and it changes your brain, and you need help with it. Mm-hmm. What I do want to say is that I'm so glad Betty called in, because my stomach was getting tied in knots over Evan's assumption that a lot of us would have two glasses of wine and then drive. I'm actually going to stop listening to the program. That was the last straw for me, Evan. There are so many of us who would not consider having even a sip of alcohol and getting behind the wheel. And the fact that you normalized that was really so disappointing that I'm done. Thanks. Bye.
All right, Ingrid, thank you for the phone call. Look, I respect your view and your decision there. I want to make clear, I'm not attempting to normalize it. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to be accountable and say that it should not be okay. And that if I have done that in the past, and I'm sure I have, that is not okay. And just because you make it home doesn't mean you ought to do it the next time. You know, when Robert was talking about the accident that killed six people, I asked him, did you have any close calls before? And he said, not that he could recall. But you get to a point where, you know, you think you can do it, and then one time you can't, and someone may be dead.
Well, and the thing I'd say is that I hear their anger, and I genuinely appreciate their anger. I hope that anger is not wasted. You know, I want people to be angry about drinking and driving, and I want them to go out and be angry enough to stand up to a friend who might be getting behind the wheel and say, like, not tonight. I'm not going to let you drive tonight.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah, Ingrid, I agree with you. I'm not... I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm trying to be accountable. I'm trying to follow my guest's lead and say, just because I didn't hit anybody on a night where I had a couple glasses of wine and drove doesn't mean that I didn't do it. I've done it. I don't think it's okay. And I think we need to get to a point where the ideals of Betty are the full culture in this country that right. says there are alternatives.
Yeah.
That's it. There's an alternative. And you've got choices. And you don't have to drink at all. So let me go ahead and read another piece that Robert wrote. Because Robert wrote about seeing others in early recovery. Part of his work as an addiction counselor brings him in contact with people in these scenarios, sometimes with opioids, sometimes with alcohol. Mm-hmm. Let me read from your piece if you could.
Sure.
I work with people daily in very early recovery. They sit in my office and cry and are angry and are desperate and scared. They sit across from me and I see myself. It would be impossible not to. The words they use, the language they use, is a close memory hermetically sealed forever in my mind. I listen to them and I hear myself. I feel sad for them and grateful that, for me, the chaos has ended. It has finally ended. I remember how it felt to have the heavy fog of eternal delusion lift and what it felt like to start to see for what felt like the first time ever. And I am so grateful for the utter simplicity of today's problems. But again, I question the cost. One simple decision. One very simple, very wrong decision. And some poor soul never gets to see their child again, their parent again, someone they love ever again, and there is no way to ever make that better. They can never be made better again. 15 years later, this is what I have to offer, not just my own victims, but the world. This is what I owe. My boundless gratitude, my eternal apologies, my diligence and determination, my thankfulness, my joy, my promise, my sobriety. Thank you to everyone, friends and families, my victims, just everyone, who has made this incredibly magical and far too meaningful journey possible. Thank you all. And please don't drink and drive. Please, just don't. Says it all, I think.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say after that.
Sometimes I just want to let the words hang and sink in there because I thought that was powerhouse stuff. But let me return you to the earlier part of that. When you work in recovery, you're going to be a recovery coach. That's what you want to do?
Yeah, yeah. I'm opening a private business so I can help people who are struggling in ways that I can't do through a hospital system.
Can people contact you already? Are you working?
I'm just starting to take on clients, yeah.
Yep. So do you not want me to ask you how they can find you?
Sure. Yeah, I have an email address. It's called abetterhigh@gmail.com.
Abetterhigh@gmail.com.
Yeah.
If you want to find Robert Veeder. But when you meet people in those early days who may feel hopeless, talk about suicide, yeah. as you thought about, yeah. Do you think that your story, as painful as it is, can help people back onto the road that you got on?
I'm sure it can. Yeah. Without a doubt. I think that that's something I can do as a coach that maybe we don't do as easily in therapy because of how therapy works, but that it's much more freeing for me to be able to look somebody in the eye and tell them assurance that things get better, that it doesn't have to be like this, that I know they can't see it right now, but you can get off the couch, you know, and get out into a world that's beyond your imagination. I have the most amazing life every day, you know, I really do.
And if you don't mind, speaking of the most amazing life, if anyone has dealt with the lows of thinking you're not going to find joy again, maybe the pain of thinking you're not going to feel just like a day can be quote-unquote normal, Robert went through incarceration. And I want to close the program with this, which I thought was amazing. Just go into the grocery store. You're right. Here's an unusual confession. I have a curiously deep love of going to the grocery store. Before Carrick can even mutter the sentence, oh, shoot, I forgot we're out of, I'm halfway to the car. It's the normalcy, the domesticity of the whole thing, I think. I hated prison. It sounds like such a stupid thing to say. Of course I hated prison. Everyone hates prison. I guess that, in retrospect, one thing that it did give me was an unusual appreciation for the otherwise mundane, like grocery stores.
Yeah.
I love that because sometimes the things that if we lost the ability to do certain things, we would do anything to have back, you don't have an appreciation until it might be gone.
Making a sandwich is a big deal right now. One of my favorite, I love stopping for gas, you know? Which sounds ridiculous, right? Because nobody wants to stop for gas. But like, I have money in my pocket. That didn't used to happen, you know? I can fill the gas tank. Are you kidding me? You know, I didn't used to be able to do that.
And for 8.5 years, you didn't have the option to be out free to go where you want to go.
And see smiling people, you know? I mean, because prisons don't do that either. Nobody smiles, you know? And not for long, you know?
I hope this hour has really been a message to all of our listeners that that Robert's story or anybody's story that even has echoes of it, you can't wave away consequence. I found the accountability. It's the reason the second you sent me that note, yesterday, by the way,
yeah.
That's how fast we turn this around. The second you sent me that note, I thought, this is a person I want to talk to because of how accountable you are. And so people like Ingrid, if you misinterpreted what I said or if you didn't like what I said, I'm accountable for it. But I'm not saying it's okay. In fact, I think we can change.
Yeah.
And I think Robert helps people change.
We have to change.
Well, you have changed a tremendous amount. And I am so grateful to meet you.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Robert Veter, abetterhigh@gmail.com. And you'll find him in Rochester's bustling recovery community. Yeah. He's right. It's a remarkable place. Short break. More connections coming up.